this week were Wilder Schmaltz and Charles Froelich. We're in the Froelich Gallery, and we've been looking at Tom Prochaska's work and Yoshihiro Kitai. And this work is probably going to be up through the end of May, since the gallery is only open by appointments because of social distancing. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Charles and Wilder.
Thanks, Joseph. We really appreciate your work.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
Andy Warhol loves a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from PDX Pendable Stage and Studio Supplies. PDX Pendable sells and rents to film and theater productions, from gel and globes to paint and lights, featuring the latest Arri LED lighting. More information available at 503-887-5880 and at pdxpendables.com.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
Major funding for the series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from PRI, Public Radio International.
This is Crossing East. Our stories, our history, our America.
And some people do call this the Ellis Island of the West. Give us your tired, your poor. And Angel Island was known at the time as the guardian of the Western Gate.
One year they say you're white, but not Caucasian. And the next year they say you're Caucasian, but not white.
And so it makes these people who are nationals into alien. They lose this kind of elevated status above alien.
The laws out of 1996 was targeted at welfare reform. And it was clear that America was telling the immigrants that we don't care about you and that we blame you for our welfare ills.
I'm George Takei. When we return, Exclusion and Resistance on Crossing East.
I'm Dime Roberts with the Crossing East music feature. In Japanese, taiko means big drum. Taiko is also the name for Japanese drum ensembles all over the world. In North America, there are more than 150 taiko groups and growing. The birth of North American taiko came in the politically charged year of 1968, the same year Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy were assassinated. Saichi Tanaka banged the big drum in San Francisco and started American taiko. Jeannie Aiko Mercer and Russell Baba of Shasta Taiko met each other while studying with Tanaka. They were instantly drawn to taiko and now have their own taiko group in Mount Shasta, California.
I had moved to San Francisco from Anchorage, Alaska in about 1969. It was very thrilling because I've never seen, you know, a Japanese musical art form so dynamic. One of the things that attracted me to it was the fact that there were quite a few women in the group. To me, to see women going all out and being so physical and creating music at the same time was very appealing to me.
Growing up and seeing all the war movies constantly, and the Japanese were the enemy, that had maybe affected me and a whole generation of young people. My stereotype of Japanese were that they were very quiet, didn't rock the boat. And then when I saw taiko, or when I went to Japan and saw festivals there or talked to Japanese nationals, they weren't quiet. in some ways, they were allowed and told you their opinions.
I was born in an internment camp in Minidoka in Idaho, so I don't really remember anything of the experience. And then, of course, after the war, I think it's true of all Japanese Americans, our parents, particularly the Nisei, you know, wanted us to be American, so we weren't really taught or exposed to really Japanese culture. I think the act of playing taiko is in itself sort of political in a way, because, you know, you are educating people, and, you know, we did perform for a lot of, and we still do, in fact, for things like pilgrimages, you know, to Tule Lake, for days of remembrance kind of things.
Before I was awakened, you know, because of the Vietnam War and the Asian movement, etc., political movements, and I was a student activist, truth was in music. For me, when I play, that says everything. You just hit the drum, and it's like I'm drumming in your face. It's who I am, this is my color, this is what I look like, this is what I'm playing.
The finances are always tough, but that's, I think that's true for everyone. But we do manage to survive here. People really appreciate what we do. I mean, there are very few Asians. We are increasingly seeing more and more. It's mostly a white population.
You know, it was like a calling, because we know how much it meant to us. We still struggle here, but we realize that drumming and that kind of activity is essential in any community, especially here when I see so many people hurting, that they're searching for something, and when they find something like taiko, it really makes a difference in any person's life.
The taiko drums themselves are made out of wood and animal skins and air. When you play the taiko, you try to connect with all those spirits. It's something almost sort of primordial in a way. I've been doing it for, 33 years now, so that says something, I think. Like, now I'm considered a senior citizen, you might say, but, you know, I think taiko has kept me young, and, yeah, I'm going to continue to do taiko as long as I physically can.
Jeannie Mercer and Russell Baba continue to tour the country and hold classes through Shasta Taiko. Their son Masato, a student of taiko since the age of 6, performs with the On Ensemble and Taiko Project in Los Angeles. For more information, go to crossingeast.org. This Crossing East music feature was produced with Sarah Caswell Colvett and is made possible by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
I'm George Takei, your host for Crossing East. Our stories, our history, our America. We present Exclusion and Resistance, Chapter 1, Yellow Peril, by John Kalish.
Hello, Peppy. I feel wacky. Just had a little a cup of sake. Yes, sir. That my baby. No, sir. A lot of meaning, maybe. Yes, sir. That my baby. No.
Comic singer Harry Stewart made a living performing as the stereotypical Harry Carey in the 1950s and 60s. This recording is part of a collection of Asian Americana at New York University. The collection shows how Asians have been viewed as the perpetual foreigner in America. Professor Jack Chen runs NYU's Asian Pacific American Studies Institute.
Even though they may be American citizens, they've always been represented as the foreigner. Sometimes as a good foreigner, the friendly foreigner. Sometimes the Japanese are our friends, and sometimes the Japanese are our evil enemies. Sometimes the Chinese are that way. Sometimes the Koreans are that way. And it's constantly flipping back and forth.
White Americans of the late 19th century expressed their fears of an Asian invasion with the term Yellow Peril. This fear led to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. It formally barred Chinese immigrants from entering the United States, the only time one racial ethnicity has been excluded from the U.S., but many other laws targeted immigrants before that.
1790, Nationality Act. Only free white persons could become naturalized U.S. citizens.
1854, People versus Hall ruled that Chinese could not give testimony in
1862,
court.
1862, California anti-coolie tax on the Mongolian race.
1882, Chinese Exclusion Act. Only Chinese merchants, teachers, students, diplomats, and tourists were allowed to come.
The Chinese Exclusion Act was repealed in 1943 as a goodwill gesture to China, a U.S. ally during World War II. At the same time, all Japanese Americans on the West Coast were detained in internment camps. Exclusionary and discriminatory laws thrived in the 19th and first half of the 20th centuries, preventing Asians in America from becoming citizens and owning property, or revoking the citizenship of American women who married Asian men. Always, there was the fear of the Yellow Peril.
On behalf of the National Park Service and the Circle Line Statue of Liberty and Ellis Island Ferry System, once again, welcome aboard. Our next stop will be Ellis Island.
From 1892 to 1924, 20 million immigrants were welcomed to America through Ellis Island of New York City. But on the other side of the country, at the Angel Island Immigration Station in San Francisco Bay, thousands of immigrants faced detention for weeks and months. Tour guide Casey Lee.
And some people do call this the Ellis Island of the West. When people think of Ellis Island, they get a very romanticized view of immigration. You have the Statue of Liberty that right next door, welcoming people, give us your tired, you're poor. And Angel Island was known at the time as the guardian of the Western Gate.
From 1910 to 1940, during the time that the Angel Island Immigration Station was in operation, Asian immigrants were locked up in stark barracks, and many endured lengthy interrogations by officials. This was not the welcome most had envisioned. Chapter 2, Angel Island, by D. May Roberts and Michael Johnson.
The fog bell clangs, and a group of 50 children exit down a ramp from a ferry to the Angel Island Immigration Station in San Francisco Bay. For 30 years, Angel Island was the entry point for close to 175,000 Chinese immigrants. Now it's a national park where tourists and students can explore a dark time in American history.
The gate up here used to lead to a covered walkway, and it would go directly to the mess hall.
Erica G., education director of Angel Island, wends her way through a maze of barbed wire fences leading to a series of yellow wooden barracks.
And essentially with the covered walkway is that once immigrants went inside the administration building, they pretty much didn't go outside again. And so most of the time they really were inside, and they didn't really have free access outside.
Immigrants from throughout the Pacific passed through Angel Island, but it was the Chinese who were detained for anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 years. Families were split up and underwent medical examinations. Then they were housed in separate quarters.
Women were held in this room probably in the first 2 to 3 years of the operations of the immigration station.
We pass through a dark hallway and enter a gray room with no curtains. G points to rows of metal bunk beds stacked three on top of each other.
You know, these people were living in very close living quarters. Women and men were separated. Women traveling with children would also have their children with them. If boys were traveling with their mom and they were about 12, 13, or 14, boys would actually be housed with the men. So for kids, this is a really scary thing. Imagine, you know, traveling and suddenly being separated. You had to go with all these men now.
G says that health code inspectors set a maximum number of 60 people to be housed in this room, but she says they always exceeded that. Everything in the room is a shade of gray, even the walls and floors. It's hard not to think of it as a dorm room in a jailhouse. The men's quarters, located in a separate building, are bigger. More men immigrated. The people housed in these barracks never knew how long they would be detained or if they were going to be deported.
So the men who were housed here would pretty much be in here all day. They would go downstairs to that mess hall, down the covered walkway, and they would go for breakfast, they would go for lunch, and then they would go maybe for a snack in the afternoon, and then a dinner. You ate your meals, You might have a time outside, but the majority of it was spent in confined into one room with lots and lots of other people.
The only other activities were the daily interrogations. Through a translator, Chinese men, women, and children were taken to a small room with a wooden desk and two chairs. They faced questioning about their lives back home and their relatives or friends in America. The interrogators were looking for any discrepancies in their stories so they could be used as reasons for deportation. Dale Ching was 16 when he arrived at Angel Island, and he remembers the fear and paranoia the interrogations brought.
Well, I was there for that many months, and I was waiting for the interrogation. When after interrogation, then we can more or less freely talk about things. Because after interrogation, we still worry about it, because some stranger might be a spy talking about the official. But you have to know who's who to talk to.
Ching now works as a docent for Angel Island, and on his tours, he talks about the lack of personal privacy.
You're going in to take a shower? No curtain. You're going into the toilet, you sit there and you come out and like that. No partition in between. The sleeping quarter, 10 o'clock, the light will go out every day. The light go out. No matter what you do, you got to go to bed. But the bathroom, yes, the light is on all the time, but you're kind of scary to go.
Ching was not alone in his reaction to the detention. Chinese detainees carved their responses all over the walls of the men's barracks.
So the poem reads, "Detained in the wooden house for several tens of days, it is all because of the Mexican exclusion law which implicates me. It is a pity heroes have no way of exercising their prowess."
Erica G. points out poetry written in Chinese characters now barely visible on the walls.
And then the second poem reads, "From now on, I'm departing from this building. All of my fellow villagers are rejoicing with me. Don't say that everything within is a Western style. Even if it's built of jade, it is turned into a cage."
A great deal of care went into creating this poetry. First, one man wrote it, then another carved the characters skillfully onto the barrack walls.
People were very aware at Angel Island that they were being discriminated against because they were Chinese and that they were unable to do anything about the situation.
Judy Young is the co-author of Island, Poetry and History of Chinese Immigrants on Angel Island. Along with Mark Him Lai and Jenny Lim, they documented the poetry and oral history of detainees.
All the poems in this collection we know were written by men, because the poems by the women were in a building that was destroyed in the fire in 1940, so we have no records of poems by women. Many of the poems, I think, reflect a sense of sadness, depression, loneliness, because these are immigrants that were being detained for weeks and months at a time, and they were just feeling very frustrated and depressed and yearning to be freed or returned home.
Random thoughts deep at night. Some ye ngao gam, ye jing mei men. In the quiet of night, I heard faintly the whistling of wind. The forms and shadows saddened me. Upon seeing the landscape, I composed a poem. The floating clouds, the fog, darken the sky. The moon shines faintly as the insects chirp. Grief and bitterness entwined are heaven sent. The sad person sits alone, leaning by a window.
Bei fu xiong lin, tin xiong hin, sao yan, dok chao, yi chong bin.
The poetry conjures up images of male detainees carving onto walls as they lay in their bunk beds in overcrowded barracks. Some of the poetry, like "The Weak Shall Conquer," talks about revenge for mistreatment.
Lao bu chui kim do mei zhao, su ji do qi lei xiang lao. Tong yue de ji xing gong ye, ding cham chou yan, chou bu lao.
Leaving behind my writing brush and removing my sword, I came to America. Who was to know two streams of tears would flow upon arriving here? If there comes a day when I shall have retained my ambition and become successful, I will certainly behead the barbarians and spare not a single blade of grass.
Judy Young considers the poetry an act of resistance and protest.
They are ways that the Chinese could vent their frustrations, express their anger, express how they feel that they've been wronged, and how they hope someday to seek revenge and to right the wrong. I think that it's one of the few evidences that we have of the early Chinese immigrants and what they thought about the Chinese Exclusion Act and the way that they were incarcerated at Angel Island Immigration Station. if you read some of the poems, it also says this is a record of what happened to us. It's also a way for us to tell those who will be following us what to expect and to console them and to encourage and support them, especially if they bother to carve them into the walls and not just penned or pencil them in. They must have thought about how this would be read by others. And I wonder if it isn't also a record of resistance for future generations.
That's what keeps Dale Ching giving tours to school children at Angel Island. He, like other former detainees, find it hard to even come back to face the fences that once locked them in.
Everybody, they mention Angel Island, they don't want to talk about it. I can see why they don't want to talk about it. At least I know I'm doing something. History is history.
Angel Island by Dimay Roberts and Michael Johnson. We had help from the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation. Find photos and links to all our stories at crossingeast.org. You're listening to Exclusion and Resistance on Crossing East. I'm George Takei.
This is PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm George Takei, your host for Crossing East. We're featuring stories about exclusion policies and resistance by Asian immigrants. During the dreaded immigration review process, Chinese immigrants were asked minute details about their family history and living conditions in China. Their answers had to agree with those of their sponsors and witnesses to prove their identities and right to enter the U.S. Since the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, every Chinese immigrant was interrogated in this way until 1943, when it was repealed. With poverty and political chaos in China, many Chinese looked to America for refuge. But with the Exclusion Act barring all but a few, Chinese immigrants had to find another way around the system. Children of parents who entered as paper sons still feel the sting of that interrogation process. Judy Young is a professor emeritus of American Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Her father entered as a paper son, and her mother as a legitimate wife of a merchant. Chapter 3, Paper Sons.
For the record, what are all your names?
My Chinese name is Tom Bickfong, but my birth certificate and everything else says that my name is Judy Young.
Your right to enter the United States will be considered by this board.
Because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, only certain classes of immigrants could come to the United States from China between 1882 and 1943.
The burden is upon you to prove that you are not subject to exclusion under any provision of the immigration laws, and all evidence in your behalf must be submitted at this hearing.
My father immigrated to America in 1921, 15 years old at the time. The way he came was that his uncle in the United States was able to buy papers that said he was the son of a merchant in Stockton by the name of Young Ung.
What are all your names?
So my father, whose name was Tom Yip Jing, his surname is Tom, came to the United States claiming to be Young Heng's son, the second son of this merchant in Stockton. The papers that were bought for him by his uncle cost $1,500, $100 for each year of age.
Advised as to the nature and penalty for the crime of perjury.
Immigration had no way of knowing who was coming in,
as a merchant or as a son or a wife of a U.S. citizen without putting them through some kind of interrogation or questioning.
For the record, why are you appearing here today?
The San Bruno, California National Archives branch has all of the Angel Island transcripts. And the reason why they kept all these files was that they had to recall files when new immigrants from the same family came through, so they would ask the same questions and see that there's a consistent pattern in terms of the responses about people's background and identities. So I was able to go there and find my mother and my father's immigration files and the transcripts of the interrogation.
What are all your names? Why are you appearing here today? Please describe the house of your maternal grandparents in which you were living at Macau.
And so those kinds of questions were asked of the immigrant, and then they would ask the same questions of the sponsor, whether it's their husband or their father, whoever was going to be the witness.
Why are you appearing here today? What are all the names you know for your husband?
And the answers had to agree.
Your wife states that the north kitchen skylight is not equipped with glass and that the smoke from the stove goes out through that skylight. What do you say to that?
One or two wrong answers could mean that you would be deportable.
What do you say to that? The burden is upon you. What are all the names you know for your husband?
And even people who were true sons and true wives would fail the examination because if the other person remembered differently. So people were really fearful of that interrogation, and they knew it was going to come, and they would have these coaching notes that they would memorize prior to even coming to this country and able to prepare for these examinations.
Alleged husband and father sworn and admonished that if at any time he should fail to understand the interpreter to immediately so state, advised as to the nature and penalty for the crime of perjury.
Those who were of the merchant class who had the right to bring their wives and children to this country would claim that they had more children than they did, and then they would sell these identities to other fellow villagers so that they can come pose as sons and daughters of the merchant class. And then in 1906, the earthquake destroyed all the birth certificates, birth records at City Hall in San Francisco. Anyone who stepped forward and claimed that they were U.S. citizens would be believed, and they could then also report that not only were they a U.S. citizen, but they had four sons in China, which then created four slots by which they could sell these slots to others in China.
Applicant 1114 was too young to testify, but gave evidence of regarding Zhu Law Ying as her mother.
And I think to the day he died, he was always worried that he's going to be deported. So he told us never to tell anyone what our real surnames were and to never tell anyone who my father really is and where he really is from.
Testimony has been taken from the alleged wife, applicant 1113, and from Young Hin Sen concerning their marriage and subsequent stay together in China.
And when my mother came in 1940, my father was the witness, and so she was asked about 100 questions. He was asked the same 100 questions.
Your wife states that the north kitchen skylight is not equipped with glass. Please describe the house of your maternal grandparents in which you were living at Macau. What do you say to that?
I'm born in this country. I know I have rights, and I'm a U.S. citizen, and I know they can't deport me, but it's just that my father always drummed this into our heads. He always made us, you know, feel very afraid of immigration and of white authorities because we're illegals, and we knew this.
Advised as to the nature and penalty for the crime of perjury. Crime of perjury. Penalty for the crime of perjury.
Just shows us how complicated and how expensive and how arduous this whole process was for everybody concerned.
No discrepancies worthy of mention were brought out by the testimony.
The paper sun system was an act of resistance. It was an act of circumvention. Resistance can also be seen as finding ways to circumvent discriminatory and unfair laws to the Chinese immigrants. And I think what those immigration documents tell us is how people had to lie in order to circumvent that immigration exclusionary law to make it into this country.
Your right to enter the United States will be considered by this board. The burden is upon you to prove that you are not subject to exclusion under any provisions.
Thank you.
Neighbor Sons by Sarah Caswell Colbert featured Judy Young and testimonies of her parents, printed in her book, Unbound Voices. From 1907 to 1917, a few thousand men and a handful of women from the Punjab area in northern India made their way to North America. The Punjab was a rich agricultural region, but under British rule, many peasant farmers could not pay the high taxes. A famine from 1899 to 1903 decimated their cattle, and the farmers ended up losing their lands. There were Hindus and Muslims among those forced to seek their fortunes in America, but most were followers of the Sikh religion. Judge Brar's father, Kehar Singh, arrived in California in 1913.
Dad and my uncle Dal Singh landed in San Francisco, and they didn't have the $5 apiece to pay the port fee. And for $5, they turned them back. Now, $5 doesn't sound like a lot of money, but it was back then.
South Asians arrived in a society that first welcomed cheap labor, then excluded each Asian immigrant group in turn. By the early 1920s, Punjabis fleeing discrimination, racism, and religious persecution were looking to settle. They sought somewhere safe, somewhere rural, to worship and live in peace. That search played a key role in fighting a legal battle that would represent all Asians in America. Chapter 4, Defining American, by Sarah Caswell Colbert.
They worked as farmers. They made their way down California's coast until they settled in Clovis, which